All right, so we're going to do four today, and I'm actually going to kind of time us on my phone. Let's see. Y'all have until 2 o'clock today, or do you need to be gone before then?
I have until 2.
You have until two. All right, so we'll do a little less than 15 minutes each for these, okay? Fast and Furious crime theory. Here we go. I want to start with biological theories of crime. So, Alex has just had a lot of this in a class earlier today, but I do have some different ones for adult offenders, so don't worry, it won't all be repeat information. But anyhow, as the name suggests, biological theories are rooting criminal behavior in biology. Shocker, right? So it could be genetics. It could be the physical appearance of someone. It could be the makeup of someone's brain. All sorts of biological causes are in there. Anyhow, some of the most damaging in criminology history are eugenics. Can anyone talk to us about eugenics just real quick?
Yeah, I mean, you said eugenics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like kind of the genes were bad, so like they like just kind of bred like undesirable traits out of a specific gene pool that they connected to people being criminals or just bad people in general. But you know, it was very much stemmed on like racism and just doing the whole us versus them thing.
Yes, very good. And so that some of those other bad traits that they felt like they could breed out of people were alcoholism, sexual promiscuity, low reading abilities, stuff like that. Anyhow, and they influenced quite a bit of society because America started sterilizing people to the tune of hundreds of thousands of people. And, you know, there's one famously evil person who took America's ideas to commit mass crimes. Who am I talking about?
Hitler.
Hitler, that's right. So he used America's eugenics and sterilization laws to inspire a lot of the stuff he did in the Holocaust against Jewish people and other groups. Yes. So that is a really dark chapter of America's biological theories. Even until today, there are some biological theories that still operate, used in both psychology and sociology to explain different types of behavior. Usually on the sociology side, they're using biological explanations for deviance. And typically, when they test those theories, a lot of them are not supported for sociology. So I want to talk through a few that have somehow survived until today and that some people try to lean on, but that are not good explanations for crime, in my humble opinion. The first is Terry Moffitt's two-path theory. He proposed this in 1993, so it's almost 30 years old now. And under this theory, the idea is that there are two groups of people who commit crimes. So there are life course persistent offenders. I don't like that this theory uses that term because it acts like it's drawing in life course theories, and I don't find a really great link between life course theories and biology theories. So I want to throw this out there. And we could even change the name if we wanted to. Instead of life course persistent offenders, we could call them career criminals. So people who are criminals for their whole life, basically. And they suggest that this group of people has antisocial criminal behavior that started in childhood and continues to get worse after that. That's one group of people, the crime group. Sorry. The other group is called adolescence limited offenders. When do you think criminal offending happens for this group? No, it's a bold guess. Adolescence limited offenders. What do you think?
Can you repeat the question?
Yes. When do you think this group's criminal offending happens?
High school?
Yeah, right. Adolescence. So basically, this group does do criminal offending, but it's limited to adolescence. He suggests that about 5% of the population is that group of career criminals who start as childhood delinquents and just continue all the way up. And there's actually one country, Germany, or sorry, not the entire country, but Hamburg, Germany, the government has used this theory to start screening primary school age children in an attempt to provide social therapeutic measures to compensate for poor parental support. So this is interesting to me. This is a biosocial theory that suggests career criminals are just born that way. They start as children and they continue committing crime as adults. And yet the city government in Germany that's using it is using social therapeutic measures to compensate for what they say is a biological cause of crime. So I love that they are realizing at an early age we can provide social support for kids who might not be getting that support at home. I don't like that they're still rooting the cause of that delinquency in biology because I'm like, this is kind of conflicting here. You're saying the solution is social and the cause is biological, but I think both are social. Anyhow, so that's one is the two-path theory. Sorry, I'm not trying to cough 100 times. We also have neurological theories of crime. So these ones look at the structure and the functioning of the central nervous system to explain criminal behavior. And to do that, they focus on several regions of the brain. And you have, of course, criminologists in this area and neurologists, right? I mean, that makes sense. Now, when criminologists are looking at the brain, they usually consider the frontal lobe in biological theories of crime, because that's the region that's associated with abstract thought, planning, goal formation, staying attention, concentration, self-monitoring, etc. One theorist with the last name of Rain carried out a study on 41 violent murderers and found reduced activity in the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system of these offenders compared to a control group of non-criminals. I don't know how I feel about that. First of all, the study group wasn't large enough. 41 homicide offenders, that is just not comparable to the entire group of people who commit homicide. Also, this person looked specifically for violent murderers and not regular murderers. And so I want to know, murder itself is violent, right? Killing someone. What distinction did they make between a violent murderer and a non-violent murderer?
That was my question. I was gonna ask, but I was like, I
Okay.
don't know if you could define the difference.
So I don't have that distinction in how they chose those people, which makes me wonder, like, did they do brain scans of serial offenders? I just anyhow, I'm not sure.
One thing I can see how I think they should have maybe done it. I mean, yeah, there's like, I see it as like kind of if that's what they saw in the prefrontal cortex, that'd be like one thing, one factor that contributes, you know, not say that like, oh, their brain wasn't okay, that's why. Because then it just, I mean, there's a lot of cases where like, you know, people's brain can be perfectly normal and it's just the social, you know, it's like the whole biological social. It's like when it comes down to this topic, it's always like either you're here or you're there. There's something called like the MANOVA gene, if I remember correctly what it's called, and it's linked to like decreased serotonin in the brain that is linked with having more aggressive behavior. So I would have seen it make more sense if they would have touched on things like that, of like how much of something they have with the hormones and like, you know, and stuff like that in the brain. 'Cause like then they could do it, like if they have a decreased gene in that sense, that isn't produced properly, then that could link that to the aggressive behavior that could possibly be linked with like the violent crimes versus groups that have normal serotonin and like dopamine that is linked to normal, like not normal murder, but you know, no, murder that isn't really necessarily as aggressive with the intent of getting satisfaction off the pain of the victims.
Because those would be two different kinds of offenders right
Yeah.
there. So I don't know. Now, if someone did a study on like 10,000 homicide offenders and had done some kind of sampling, like stabilizing measure, then I'd be like, oh, okay. I'll listen. I'll see what you have to say about brain structure. But on a study of only 41, and you haven't told me how you picked that group of 41, anyhow, but there's that study. They've also looked into individuals with antisocial personality disorder, also known as psychopathy. Shocker here. Those individuals display a decrease in emotional response and lack of empathy with others, which is basically the definition of that disorder. And they say that these symptoms have been found in many offenders. Now, I don't like the way that they're making that bold statement, that symptoms of psychopathy are found in many offenders, because we know that many offenders are not psychopaths. We know that most offenders do feel empathy and do have emotional response, to the point that they have to create their own code and guilt management system to decrease their guilt and justify what they're doing when they do commit a crime. So I don't like their suggestion at all. Now, if they're calling aggression a symptom of psychopathy, then yes, let's apply that. For violent crimes, of course, there's going to be a level of aggression applied in those crimes, but the aggression is not a direct link to psychopathy. Because that is something that a very, very minor percentage of the population struggles with and explains their personal criminal offending. So I don't like that little scapegoat they tried to throw in there with these theories. I'm like, ooh, watch how you're publishing your research. That's not accurate.
I feel it ties into like how originally eugenics was seen, like when it first came up. Like it's like, no, this is a bad thing. Like their brain is not good. Like they're bad. Like this is what labels them. And I mean, this is the same thing. It's just it doesn't sound as crazy to us. But I mean, again, eugenics didn't sound as crazy to people back in the day when they first brought this up. So I mean, I feel it very much is like the same thing used to like discriminate against and cause like a bubble of like this is the stereotype that fits into it because look it's even on the inside of the brain that does it. So it's like it makes it feel like you should believe it even more because it's like it's an organ, you know, that they scanned and they did all these tests on and whatever. So I feel like kind of is the same thing. We're not stemming too far from what eugenic things are being claimed.
And then to get to the serotonin thing you mentioned, I do have an example of that in these theories as well. My goodness, excuse me. The cold is real today. Okay, so researchers have looked into reduced levels of serotonin, and they claim that there's a link to criminal behavior. And serotonin, or sorry, they've also looked at neurotransmitters that are in control of impulsivity. And wouldn't you guess it? When they find people who seem to have lower amounts of those neurotransmitters, they have lower self-control. That sometimes that results in criminal offending. Weird how those would all be linked. And they also suggest if someone has an increased level of, and gee, you might have to correct my pronunciation, norepinephrine? Norepinephrine. How's that? Yeah, okay. That chemical can result in aggressive behavior. Now, my issue with this is that it falls back on the idea that we have more male offenders because of testosterone. And I don't think it's testosterone that's the case. I think we socialize people incorrectly. I don't think we teach people how to be angry or just upset about things properly. I think if we socialized people in healthy ways to manage anger, when they were feeling aggressive, it wouldn't turn into a problem. It wouldn't matter if they had an extra hormone making them aggressive or not. They would still know how to manage it. When I have these feelings, I react this way. But we don't do that today. We tell a lot of people, don't talk about your feelings, don't cry, don't this, don't that. And so then we don't give them any healthy coping mechanism for it. So I think that's kind of a bunch of baloney, honestly, about the aggressive brain chemicals. I think we can easily still socialize that to be healthy, because if you think about it, back in medieval times, they were constantly having these battles and stuff between warriors. And like, if you wanted to have the farmland next to you, you just went and killed the farmer. Like, boom, you're gone. Today, we understand, hey, when you're neighbors with someone, if you want their lawn, you can't just go kill them, right? We've taught that. We've taught out actually a lot of aggression, which is why our violent crime rates have been increasingly going down for the most part, minus some of the kind of celebrity crimes today. But In general, the violent crime trends are down. So I think it still lands on socialization either way. Let's see. They've done some genetic studies to look into children who were adopted and compare the criminal offending between adopted children and their biological parents who did not raise them to see if there's any link. One study they did was on 14,427 adoptees. They did this study in 1984. They found that 13% of adoptees whose adoptive and biological parents were never convicted of a crime were convicted. So 13% of those adopted kids were convicted of crimes. And then 14% of those kids who were adopted and their biological parents had been committed of crimes were also committed of crimes. Those numbers are almost identical, even though one group had a biological relationship to parents who were committed of crimes. Not a very strong study result, right? I mean, if there was a huge difference, we'd see something like, oh, 75% of kids who were adopted had biological parents who were also criminals. There's not a strong comparison. Yeah. Anyhow. They've done some study on gene environment interactions. That for me just kind of that's getting real sticky. So that's where they look at a gene and then they try to measure the environmental response on someone who has that gene and they suggest changes their behavior. That's just too far for me. Suggesting that, oh, if you have this gene and you're exposed to this pollutant, your criminal behavior is going to change. That's too much. I just think the simple answer is the best one if there's usually a social cause. Yeah. So, that's probably the extent of biological theories that I want to talk about. Do you all have any questions about those? Off the top of your head, can you think of any modern examples of how these theories play out?
I mean, just the brain ones, because I think it's the most common thing, especially when you see like the court cases and whatnot, and how people like make all these documentaries of how like inside the mind and how they take their brain and want to use it.
Yeah. And I think we even have this fascination with like non-criminal people as well, you know, like people wanting to scan Albert Einstein's brain or stuff like that, you know, fascinates us about the brain structure of certain people. I think that sometimes we just can't accept that some people are just smart and it's not necessarily a structural thing. It's just they're just smart. I don't know. You know. Some people just make bad choices. Some people, like Mother Teresa, they're just like really great humans who sacrifice a lot for others. You just have to accept that, you know, anyhow. All right, let's get into reintegrative shaming. This is a fascinating one, and I really haven't talked about it too much in my classes with you all before. This comes from John Braithwaite, an Australian criminologist. According to this theory, he says societies can have lower crime rates if they communicate shame about crime effectively. And so, in contrast, he says those or other societies will have a lot of violence if violent behavior is not shameful. So, he said those societies that don't communicate shame well about violent behavior will have high rates of sexual assault, especially if it's something men can brag about. They will also have an endemic of white collar crime if business people think law breaking is clever rather than shameful. So basically, for him, controlling crime is about having this reintegrative shaming. Now, he says there are also ways that societies can communicate shame towards crime that is only stigmatizing. America. What? He didn't say that. I did. So he said reintegrative shaming is important because it communicates shame to a wrongdoer in a way that encourages them to desist. Essentially, encourages them to make better choices in the future and still be part of the community. Stigmatization does not do that. It shames in a way that makes things worse. So what's the difference? Let's get into that. Reintegrative shaming communicates disapproval, but continues to have respect for the offender. So the offender is treated as a good person who has done a bad deed. Stigmatization is just disrespectful shaming. The offender is now just a bad person. Stigmatization also doesn't leave room for forgiveness. It's a permanent label. But reintegrative shaming forgives. And societies that use this practice will actually have ceremonies to certify that deviance can be undone or forgiven through a certain ceremony, which is interesting because in societies that really just stigmatize people for crime, America, there's a ceremony that degrades a person and labels them as criminal, right? And we see that through our criminal justice process of you enter the court system, you have a criminal record. If you go to prison, you lose your clothes, you receive a number, you're searched, your life routine's all messed up. When you come out, all these opportunities are cut off from you. But reintegrative shaming has an opposite style of ceremony where you're actually built up in a way that makes you want to hopefully not do that action again. So I have an example of this. I'll just apologize ahead of time for mispronouncing a lot of words in this. So there was an Afghan criminologist that provided an example of this from Afghani society. So he was talking about a large ethnic group in Afghanistan. They had an institution called the Nanti, and that's spelled Nanante. The Nanante was practiced, and that group, sorry, is called the Pushtun. So the Nanante ceremony is where the criminal offender would bring flour and other food and kill a sheep to have a community feast. This feast would usually be held at the victim's house, where the victim would participate in cooking the food that the offender provided. At the ceremonial part of this event, the offender is told not that he's bad and in need of reform, but that he did an injustice to the victim. That's what he's told by the people. And at the same time, he's told, "You're one of us and we accept you back among us." The police and the courts have virtually no presence in communities that use the Nanante to resolve conflict and criminal offenses because they don't need them, which is fascinating. So that's one example of it done well. Now, another country that is used as an example of this, and I have talked about them, is Japan. I don't agree with them as an example, but since Braithwaite used them in his original writing of the theory, I'll just share what he wrote about it, and then I'll tell you my problem with it. He says that Japan probably relies the heaviest on reintegrative shaming, if we had any society in the world for an example. He also points out that Japan has a very low crime rate, and it's the only nation where the evidence indicates a sustained decline in crime rate over the past half century. He says they have a low imprisonment rate, 37 per 100,000. Man, goals, America, seriously, compared to ours, which is over 500 per 100,000. Now, he talks about how this practice starts in Japanese schools. They use reintegrative methods to start disciplining school children so that when they become adults, this practice is already normalized. So here's an example of how they handle delinquency in a Japanese classroom. So the students would have to answer questions by their homeroom teacher to explain their actions if they had done something wrong in the class. This is often done in the kid's home in front of their parents. Then they would have a meeting with all the students and parents who were involved in the situation. So if this was a fight that had occurred with students from another school, they would all be invited, all the parents would be invited, and all the teachers who witnessed it. The police might also attend and make some comments. And in these meetings, the teachers would lead it. They'd usually start talking about the incident and how it affected the students. Those who were involved would have to talk about the effects it had on themselves. And then the students who were responsible would have to explain why they did it. And they would also have to apologize to everybody there. Usually there would be separate meetings between the offending students and their homeroom teachers later on. Depending on how serious the incident was, they might have some other punishments introduced besides just having this kind of apology session. But what happened is that there were strong feelings that the students should not be given up on just because they acted out in deviance. And there was a lot of effort put into correcting their behavior for the future. Now, for adults, this has become a little bit more extreme in Japan. So one thing that will happen sometimes is if an adult offender commits, a particularly heinous crime, the parents are expected to commit suicide to show the dishonor. So what happens is there's a lot riding on people not to commit heinous crimes because their family will be dishonored or hurt by themselves, more than a criminal offense or criminal record. And so that really increases the family ties and the pressure, especially because we know that most people are not committing crime from a place of psychopathy. So if you think about it, let's say we have a burglar in Japan who wants to break into another house. That burglar now has to consider, I am not just breaking into the house of a stranger. They might be able to mitigate the guilt for an offending a stranger. Who cares? I don't know that person. But they have to understand, if I'm caught, my parents will be blamed for my crime. And if it's bad enough, my parents might commit suicide if they feel like I've caused them enough shame. That right there is going to be a lot harder for a burglar to justify than a different style where they feel like they're only offending a stranger. In this case, they're offending a stranger and their family. So that's the argument about why Japan's so good at crime. I think that practice is good for their schools. I think they need to relieve some of the pressure the family feels if someone commits a crime. I don't think people should feel like their lives have no value if a family member commits crime. That's very extreme for me. In addition, we have seen this only works if people have an audience, and that is true for the feeling of shame. So, can anyone tell me the difference between the feeling of shame and the feeling of guilt?
I think shame is just like in the moment type of thing. Like in that moment, I felt shame for what I did. But guilt is like the post. It's like guilt is like afterwards. I'm still reflecting on it. I don't feel comfortable about it. Like you can't let it go. I think shame would be like in the moment, guilt carries on with you.
Okay, anyone else? So shame usually requires an audience. So, like in the moment when people are around you, guilt can be felt individually or in front of people, but you don't necessarily have to have an audience to feel guilty about something, right? And that's why it can have that kind of lingering effect, is because even after you've left the situation that created a negative feeling, you can still feel guilt even by yourself. So the thing with shame in Japan is that in World War II, when their soldiers didn't have an audience of their family members and they were in another country invading, they did atrocious crimes against humanity. They did the live body experiments in northern China. They massacred millions of civilians in southern China. I mean, they had competitions to cut people's heads off with their samurai swords. They were killing infants in front of their parents, just torturing them cruelly before killing them because they didn't have an audience. So the reintegrative shaming no longer worked. So that's my issue with it. What we really need is reintegrative guilt. We need individual offenders to feel bad about breaking the law by themselves. And so I think that would be the fix-all. I don't know how to give that to people. So if anyone figures it out, let me know. But yeah, that's reintegrative shaming. Any questions about that? Any examples you can think of from either how America doesn't do that or how a place does do that?
I think I have a question more for you of like, remember that one example where you were studying abroad, you were in China, right?
Yeah.
So I remember that example you told us of the little kid that I think had hit the teacher assistant or something, or had hit you or another student, but you had a meeting with the parents, but the parents didn't take you serious at all with like the grade matter. Like I think that you told me they laughed or
Yeah.
something like that, right? So like I'm just curious. I mean, we are talking about China, right? And Japan, you know, we're talking about two different things, but just do you think that that is something that could also explain, like, for example, that behavior of the student? Do you think it would have worked if it would have been like the family to feel some type of guilt in any example of any country when it's like the parents don't seem to care. You know, like what do we do with the theory with like when we have parents like that? Like they really could not care less if they're shamed. They're not going to commit suicide if their kid does something. You know, like how
Right.
would like, you know, approach it when, because, you know, me and my career that I'm trying to go to, you know, I have a hope that every parent that I speak to will see the matter of like when I have a child that isn't, you know, doing the right thing, they're going to give me the reaction of like, okay, let's do something about it. Thank you for sharing. Not that they laugh at me.
Yeah. So
So.
that's a good example of like the shaming function in individual families, because that family is exactly what Braithwaite's talking about. There will be a lot of violence if violent behavior is not shameful. When I told those two caregivers, hey, this kid hit my teacher's assistant, they didn't shame the behavior. In contrast, I had other parents who were extremely ashamed if I had to meet with them and say, hey, your kid did this in class, it was inappropriate. They took it upon themselves. And it was the opposite. The behavior the kid did was shameful. They wanted to work towards it. So I had the opposite in the same culture, which is similar to America, in that I don't think there's as much of a blanket approach on the family level like you might see in Japan. I think China and America do have that kind of individual where you had that one kid in class where they didn't shame him for that. And they were like, no, it's fine. You can hit your teacher. That's funny. And I had other families who were the complete opposite that were like, my kid did what? You know, like, oh, we're going to talk about this. Like, so I think that for those situations, it just depends on what behavior they're praising.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, Alex.
I don't know about all this, but with the whole idea of being in the stocks and people throw rotten fruits and vegetables at you. Okay.
Yes, very good. That was Western society's use of stigmatizing, right? You just, if you want someone to stop doing something, you just embarrass them almost to death. Put them in stocks, throw tomatoes and whatever else at them. And it's interesting that Europe used a lot of those strategies in medieval times, and European societies are also, you know, known for not having great forms of crime control. Although there's a few like in the North Scandinavian areas that are getting a little bit better in recent years, but still. Okay. Are you ready to move on to routine activity theory? Okay. This one I think is very straightforward, and you've all had it at other times in my class, so we won't spend too long on it. Can anyone tell me how does routine activity theory explain crime?
Is this a theory that says if you're like in activities and involved in things that you're not going to commit crimes? Is that the right theory?
That's social control. This one kind of has like
I
three
might say,
variables. Oh, go ahead, G.
I don't think I've covered this theory maybe with you before, but I can take a guess. I don't know. Routine. I mean, I'm just remembering you've given us advice to not be in a routine with our daily lives and how we do stuff because that can make it easier for people to pick up on that.
Yes, you're remembering one of their acronyms called CRAVED.
Okay, then I think
Yes.
yeah.
So they when they researched this, they said basically crime target is one that is craved. It's concealable, removable, available, valuable, enjoyable, and disposable. And this can be, I know, we're talking about humans, those are terrible adjectives, but if you apply them to human situations, it can map out a lot of crimes that happen to people. Obviously, for property crime, this explains a lot, which is also why, as electronics got smaller, theft went up. And then as electronics became more locked down, they were no longer available, right? Like you could steal an iPhone, but good luck breaking into it. Or someone's going to use Find My iPhone and go find the phone that you stole. So anyhow, electronics are a good way to map this out. You can also apply it to the different violent crimes though, like robbery. You know, if you think, ooh, right now I'm kind of concealed, I'm in a dark place, you could be a target. If you make sure you're walking in an area that's got a lot of people who can see you or is really well lit, it's going to decrease your availability as a target. But anyhow, the reason they focus on target so much is because they see three elements coming together to create a crime. Anytime three of these elements are together, they say a crime will happen. So you can have an accessible target, the absence of capable guardians, and the presence of a motivated offender.
I remember this.
It's also called rational choice theory because it maps out crime as a rational choice.
That's what we have it down. Well, at least me on my notes, that's how we have it.
Okay, yeah. There's another acronym to describe an accessible target. It's called VIVA, value, inertia, visibility, access. VIVA, craved. I don't really care if you remember either of those, unless you become a routine activity theorist and you're just publishing stuff in that content constantly. But the whole idea is, how easy is that target to offend or harm or steal, whatever, you know? And then looking at a capable guardian, that's the human element or one of the human elements to this equation. But sometimes it can be CCTV or some kind of like monitoring system. Now, it has to be placed in the correct area. Just because you have a security camera that's pointing the wrong direction, guess what? It's no longer a capable guardian, right? You got to have it pointed at the thing you want, and people need to know it's there. So hidden cameras can serve a time and a place, but for the most part, you want people to see the cameras that you have because it's a detractor. It's going to make them not want to break in or not want to shoplift or not want to vandalize, whatever. Whatever you're using that monitoring system for. Now, the human capable guardians can be quite a few different types of people. They can be police officers, security guards, vigilant staff, coworkers, friends, neighbors, door staff. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be a soldier with a gun guarding your house in front, right? It can be a variety of capable guardians. But we also see this in like children's programs or anything in which youth are involved in activities. Capable guardians are just more than two adults who are not married or related to each other, right? That's how we can decrease a lot of sexual assault, is making sure in church children's programs, there is always three adults present with eyes on the kids, not just two, and they can't be married or related because you can get people with weird quirks who find each other and get married to do terrible things. So you have three people at all times who are with the kids or the teenagers. That decreases sexual assault right there. Because even if you have two out of the three adults who want to commit a sexual offense against one of those kids or teens, they won't, because the one adult there who's a guardian and doesn't want sexual assault to happen. It's not the same if you have two. The reason it's not the same if you have two is, thanks to sociology, we know that a triad is the most complicated human relationship that exists in friendships, in coworkers, and whatever, because you'll always have the two against one. In a partnership or dyad, you will not. The two can easily unite, and you can have two sexual offenders who want to victimize the kids or teens. But in the three, it will almost always be too complicated for those offenders to do that. That's great. They should just, if they mandatory made that in all kids' programs and activities for teenagers and everyone, they could stop sexual assault outside the home. It'd be just so wonderful. But yeah, you have probably yourself been a capable guardian to stop people's cars from getting stolen or things from getting shoplifted and not even known it. Just for the fact that you were in a place and an offender realized, I can't do this crime right now or I'm going to be seen.
That happened to me yesterday at Target. I was trying to get some hand sanitizer because I like to have a little hand sanitizer spray in my car. And right next to it was like these drinks. And this girl was trying to open it to, like, I guess taste it. But like I came in right when she was gonna like open the pack to take the thing up. But it didn't look like she was gonna buy it because she was doing it on the shelf still. Like, you know, if she, like she didn't put it in her cart yet. And I heard the And then that's right when she looked over and like she just kind of paused right there. You know, I kind of just I went to the other aisle because I was like, how are you gonna be
Yep, very good job. You saved the drink. And then the motivated offender is the last part of this triangle to create, you know, the perfect equation for a crime. So, a crime can only be committed if the offender thinks a target is suitable. This can be a person or an object, and that the guardian nearby is incapable or that there's not a guardian nearby. All of those things. So they created this crime triangle, and of course, on each side, they had offender, target, lack of a guardian. But now they've created another triangle to go around that. So for the target or victim, the solution is a guardian. For the motivated offender, the solution is a handler. And for the lack of capable guardian, the solution is a manager. So basically, making sure in our areas with targets, which can be things to be stolen, houses to be broken in, kids or teenagers, women walking at night, people in nightclubs, wherever, whoever they are, managers are people who make sure in this area I have control of. If someone wanted to commit a crime, how could I stop them from doing that? So when you're thinking about your own house, you're the manager. If I don't want someone to break into my house, how can I make it seem like it's always being watched? Where do we park our cars? How do we control our lights turning on and off? How do we secure our entries and exits? Things like that. If you're the manager of a store, how do I make sure all the items that are being offered to be sold can be seen by me or a video camera at all times so that no one can sneakily get away with it? Things like that can help you be a manager. On the other side, we do need handlers to work with already identified motivated offenders. They need to be working on decreasing that motive in an offender to keep doing that crime. Now, here, if we had to give a report card, obviously America's failed. So we do not do a good job of decreasing the motive to commit crime. Our system's horrible. We basically give people more motivation to do crimes once they've had experience with criminal justice. It's like, come on, we gotta change this. But yeah, that is routine activities theory in a nutshell. Any questions? Sorry, I just muted. Hopefully, I didn't unmute myself to cough. We're going to power through life course theory. You all are doing great. Do you know anything about life course theory to start with?
Yes, because we talked about it this morning.
Yes, so you're in the hot seat. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so throughout the course of someone's life, it like gives them more forgiveness to change and trying to figure out how to explain it. It kind of says like just because someone was deviant at one point in their life doesn't mean that they're always going to be. Like if you're a rebellious teenager, it doesn't mean you're going to be a criminal adult.
Very good. So, life course theory looks at the whole spectrum of someone's life and the choices people make that bring them to their criminal behavior. They don't believe it's just a one-stop shop where something happens and that's it. You are forever committing crime. They suggest that there are factors and processes that someone goes through as children, and it can contribute or influence the reasons behind their deviance as adults. Life course theories will usually bring in ideas from others as well. So they'll bring in stuff from strain theory, labeling, differential association, social control, which is why they have some very strong explanations behind people's criminal behavior. And they look at a few different principles to explain criminal offending. So first they look at timing, and they suggest that people can change with time. Right. So maybe people were doing juvenile delinquency, but then they matured. And as young adults and older adults, they are no longer breaking the law. They also look at time and place, that as you grow, you could be likely to move locations. And by moving location, it could move you away from deviant peers, which brings in differential association. As your associations change, your behavior might change, right? Makes sense. Pretty logical. They also look at the principle of human agency. So this is if someone realizes, this area I'm in is not safe, there's not a lot of financial opportunity, maybe I can move and get a new job so I have better opportunities. They've made a decision not to commit deviance. They're going to try to use conventional ways to escape their environment that might be kind of negative. And that brings in strain theory. They also look at human development and they suggest you might grow out of deviance as you get older. Your priorities might change, your responsibilities might change. And then they also look at how linked lives change our criminal offending. And so as you get older, more than likely you'll have more responsibilities towards other humans, not just in the whole like you might have offspring you need to take care of, but you might have older family members who are now your responsibility to take care of. And that brings in social control theory because your time and your bonds are tied up to someone who's not encouraging you to commit a lot of crime necessarily. And that's life course theory. Any questions? They are really interested in trigger points and the way trauma influences our lives. So they might be interested in investigating how our educational opportunities influence criminal offending, or how our income might influence criminal offending, things like that. They do a lot of longitudinal studies that are 10, 20 years long. They might also be interested in things like how someone's behavior changes after losing an important relative to them, or how someone's behavior changes after a romantic relationship dissolves, things like that. And I said this morning, this is a very human style theory for me. They really consider, that humans change and grow and that we have potential to improve our behavior. There's not just this label that you should receive after you make one bad choice. So I like that. Can you think of any examples of behavior that matches this theory, either for good or for bad?
I don't know. Now I'm just thinking that since I know everything about social control theory, I should try to explore maybe like a backup theory in this life one. I kind of like it too because it touches like it even touches on the psych stuff that I take note of, especially with like the developmental psychology with like literally your brain is wired differently at different stages of your life. So what if I just do that one so I don't have to? I just always preach social control theory. I just don't shut up about it. Like, I should try to consider part two. What if someone asked me, like, what's another one, though? That's the only one? You have all this knowledge and you only want to talk about one? I don't have an example. I just wanted to share
Oh, that's fine. I
I mean,
mean,
you can say me as an example.
yourself as an example, okay.
Well, just how I was like a rebellious teenager and now I'm not.
Yeah.
A rebellious teenager, an academy student. Come on.
My mom is right here. She could probably,
Oh,
she says she can vouch for that.
okay.
But I'm good now.
Alex is a wonderful student now, ma'am. Do not worry. Enjoy
Thank you.
behavior.
She was laughing.
Alex's mom's a real MVP in this. She survived those rebellious years and got you to go to school. Hey,
Yeah,
what makes
she
you
said I have
think?
plenty of gray hair.
Oh man.
Fine.
Yeah, I think life course theory is a it's just so strong because strain theory might explain one crime in someone's life or one chapter of their life, but it can't explain the rest. Or something, but I think life course theory kind of takes all of that into account. That's why I think their ideas are so strong.
Yeah, and like when I'm imagining it, like you know how the social control theory, we have that really nice diagram that you made for us of like for the broken bonds where we don't have the broken bonds. Like I'm imagining that being placed if your life was divided into sections, like social control theory
Yes.
being in like each section, because it's right. Like like if I have strong family attachments and then I don't know in the future I don't got family that supports me no more. Like it's gonna inevitably affect the way I do my life.
Yeah.
What I have today, I
I
might
have to
not have
confess,
tomorrow.
I did not make the diagram, but I found it and I put it up in class. I'll just say that. But yes, 100%. All right, well, are we good to conclude today or do you want to talk about anything else? Thumbs up. Okay, thanks so much. I'll see you next week on Zoom, and I'm excited to hear your final ideas about which theory is the winner.
Yes. All right. See you guys Monday. Bye, podcast listeners. We're gonna miss you guys.
They'll miss you too. They've been loving these.
Bye-bye.